Welcome back, everyone, to the Sim Racing Den podcast. And before I introduce my guest, I want to let you know that this podcast is available in both video and audio only versions. If you're watching on YouTube but prefer to listen on your favorite podcast platform, check the description below for links to Spotify, Google, or Apple Podcasts. If you're listening to this now but prefer to watch the video version on YouTube with visuals throughout the conversation, visit the Sim Racing Den channel on YouTube. My next guest is Greg DeGeorges, a lifelong car nut and motorsports purist. After graduating from Penn State with a degree in mechanical engineering, he's worked tirelessly in professional motorsports, having engineered and strategized with teams to countless wins and world championship titles. In Ferrari Challenge, Lamborghini Super Trofeo, IMSA's Prototype Challenge, and several endurance series. He then launched Simmetric Labs in 2018, bringing a professional sim racing lab on the road to IMSA and USF Pro Championship races all over the United States to support real racers in finding an edge over their competition. Greg then went on to develop the Chicane Club to provide the most authentic motorsports experience for enthusiasts and the ultimate performance development tool for real-life racers. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Greg as much as I did. Greg, thanks so much for joining me. You know, we've talked before briefly, but I'm really excited to kind of share with everyone some of the things we talked about, your background, the Chicane Club, racing, sim racing in general. You're a source of lots of knowledge when it comes to racing and sim racing. So I'm so excited to have you on. I know it was a little bit tough. Our schedules were both kind of busy. You're very busy traveling and doing the different race weekends as well. I heard you were in Watkins Glen, I think, most recently. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was there up until this past Sunday afternoon. But yeah, thank you for having me on. I'm a huge admirer of your YouTube channel. I've been watching your stuff for a long time. I learn a lot from you. So I know you're paying me the compliments, but you have done a lot of really cool stuff. So
thank you.
Super professional. And that's what drew me to, you know, so dropping an email and be like, hey, we should talk sometime.
I know. This is the beauty of sim racing. Like, isn't it amazing? Like, this hobby and this passion and this you know, training, it's a training tool. It's brought in people all over the world together. Like, I could never say before that I know people from different people from the States, different parts of the States. I know people in Australia, China now. It's just amazing how this brings us together all around motorsports and racing, right? We all share the same itch for going fast, right?
Yeah, it's pretty spectacular when you look at like the state of sim racing in the year 2024. I'm not the first person to come up with this, but like the whole idea that of sim racing being the democratization of motorsports and just really kind of opening it to the masses is really incredible. I mean, like, you can go get a football and or a soccer ball and kick it around in a grass field. That's pretty cheap to do, but to the entry level point for going to do real motorsports does not involve anything but thousands of dollars to get started. I mean, you can go to K1 speed and go race a go-kart or whatever, but even that adds up really quickly.
It does.
At a very, very low level. So sim racing has totally changed that. And obviously the past couple of years with COVID and the pandemic and everyone going indoors, and obviously the nature of sim racing being that we can do it from home and with just an internet connection, it's been pretty cool. The fact that like you can go onto an iRacing lobby now and be racing people from South America and North America and Europe and the Middle East and Asia and Australia, and no one's even thinking about the fact that we're all thousands of miles apart from each other. That's just the norm, I think, is awesome. Like, it's not even the cool part anymore. Like, it's just normal to be on this very low latency. And Garrett was doing a race in here earlier today, and like, I was looking at all the locations for the guys, and I'm like, it just occurred to me that like, that's not even news to anyone anymore. Like, that's just so cool that we can be racing simultaneously. So it is. Anyways, it's a pleasure to be here. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's so cool. And glad we've connected and looking forward to this conversation. I think everyone's going to enjoy it. So we got to start with your background, because when we first spoke, you know, I had no idea kind of where this started, where you came from, the amount of experience you have. You come from a racing motorsports background first, not sim racing, right?
Correct.
So yes. Take us back. Tell me, what's your story, Greg?
I'll try to make this as short as I can.
No, we got time.
Yeah. So most people don't believe me, and they're like, think I'm pulling their leg when I tell this story. But my first word that I ever spoke was the word car. Car. Not mom, not dad, not anything like that. Car. As I was watching the Indy 500 at like, I don't know, 2 years old or whatever it was, So I was kind of just born with this attachment to cars, and I do not even come from a family of people who really necessarily are into cars or racing. They're not against it. They just, I grew up in the middle of the woods in Pennsylvania. Like, race cars was not just kind of a regular topic of conversation for us. So I just had this infatuation with cars from an early age that my parents did. They fueled for me as much as they were able to. Had go-karts, whatnot, grew up in the Gran Turismo generation. Like,
yep, me too.
I mean, you Need for Speed, but the first true driving simulator, quote unquote, was Gran Turismo 2, which I actually keep on the shelf back over my shoulder here now, because it's like, this was the genesis of all of it for me. So they made that mistake buying that for me for Christmas one year, or Santa got it, excuse me. But yeah, I fell in love with racing from Gran Turismo. I don't know, 7, 8 years old, whatever it was. The next big step for me was my brother's, went through Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts. I'm an Eagle Scout. My brother's Cub Scout leader was a Ferrari North America master technician. Shout out to Jim, if you're watching, you probably will at some
point. Hey, Jim.
So Jim was the master technician for Ferrari North America in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey. So when cars would come over from Europe, they would go through, at the time, through that building before they would get shipped to dealership. And they were, by nature, a factory extension. So like, they could actually change parts on the car, or it could be damaged and fixed, and there's no record of it because the car technically hasn't even gone to the dealership yet. So Anyways, he was the lead technician in North America for Ferrari. So he's done and seen a lot of really cool stuff. So that was the 80s and 90s. So, you know, 288 GTOs, 348s, Testarossas, F40s, 333 SPs, they all went through his hands. And he taught the people that taught all the mechanics how to work. So, like, he is the authority on that era of Ferraris. And he's since gone to work at dealerships, Ferrari challenge teams. I'll come back to Jim in a little bit because he comes back into the story. But anyways, he took my brother and the Cub Scout group and myself to the Watkins Glen 6-hour weekend in 2001 or something. So I was 10 years old at the time, for a Ferrari challenge weekend. And hey, I knew some people here, come see some stuff. And I'm like, race cars? Yes, sign me up. And
yes, really,
the only kids that actually went, it was my brother and I and Jim and his kids, and no one else came because no one else cared, which was crazy to me. But anyways, go to Watkins Glen, pouring rain. I got to meet Hurley Haywood at, like,
wow,
10 years old, which was super cool. I think we were talking last time that you had a model of a car that I'm like, Hurley Haywood drove that car, and I have a
photograph of him. Did you have any idea at the time, like, who he was, or you just kind of...
No, I've only grown to know how cool he was back then. So that moment gets cooler and cooler the older I get. Wow. When I realize who he was. But yeah, it was cool. And then also a kind of cool thing that happened that weekend is that I got to meet some of the people that Jim had worked with when he was in Ferrari Challenge, a bunch of engineers. One of the engineers I met at 10 years old, I have since worked with for a number of years.
Is that so?
To John Shapiro. Yeah, I didn't know at the time, but that's actually, Jim got me in contact with him. But anyways, people that I met at a very young age, I have now since worked with and collaborated with on a bunch of things. So it's cool when the heroes become the kind of the equals or the coworkers or whatnot.
But yeah.
All right. So I wanted to be a race car driver, like everyone who's infatuated with racing.
Me too.
But like I said, racing is really expensive, and sim racing had not blossomed into what it is yet. I mean, you can go buy the Logitech. I had a G27 or whatever.
This was what, early 90s or 2000s?
Now we're talking 2000s.
Okay. So yeah, we have Logitech wheels, and yeah.
Thrustmaster, I think, had just come out as like the, whoa, this is super cool. And it was like, I had it clamped down to like a little a coffee table, and then had an office chair pushed up against the sofa, and then the 2x4 frame for Gran Turismo 4, driving the Nürburgring at, I don't know, 12 years old, whatever it was. And that was just, you know, the gaming thing. So you asked if I was a racer or a gamer first. Technically, I was a gamer first, long before I ever got the opportunity to work in racing. But that was just like the, I love this part, I want to go racing. Family's like, that's dangerous and a lot of money. So no, politely, that's cool.
How about hockey? But, that's not dangerous.
Yeah, go do literally anything else. So I'm like, okay, well, I'm really good at math. I really like science. Maybe engineering is the path that I go. So most of high school, I did well in school. Didn't love school, but I was good at it. And I chose to go the path of mechanical engineering. So I got my degree in 2014 from Penn State. I'm a proud Nittany Lion. I did Formula SAE for 4 of my 5 years there. And I was very involved with fabrication design, a lot of the back-end admin, finding sponsorship, the presentation. I was a driver for 2 of the years. And that was the first opportunity to really like work on a racing team. And we had to design a car, which, you know, most people outside of Formula One don't actually, the teams themselves don't actually design the
car.
No,
that's true, right? You get a car and then it's up to you.
You just go racing.
Set up, tuning.
Yeah. So that was a very intense environment that I really enjoyed. And I spent just as much time doing Formula SAE as I did my studies. And frankly, for me, with what I've done now, my degree was worth a lot. It taught me a lot of things, but on a day-to-day basis, what I did in Formula SAE in college serves me a lot more than heat transfer or thermodynamics or fluid dynamics. It all works together, but Formula SAE was huge for me. So during my summers at college, Jim, coming back into the story, had since opened up his own independent Ferrari service shop 1.3 miles from where I lived in Pennsylvania, which, by the way, is in the middle of the woods, like super rural. Boom, out of nowhere pops a Ferrari shop, mile
what are the
from
chances
the house.
Of that? Jeez.
Like, all right, this is my calling. Like, this is the thing I have to go do now.
Yeah, it was fate.
So at the time, again, I didn't come from a car family. We weren't wrenching on cars. There wasn't stuff to, I grew up on a farm. We had horses and chickens, so lawnmower or quad, whoever, we were doing oil change on the pickup truck, whatever it was. My parents supported me, but again, my dad was a builder. My mom was a manicurist turned into a builder. So just cars wasn't our thing. But so coming out of high school, kind of at the same time I'm going to college, I started detailing cars. Just like $100, give me your Honda Civic, I'll detail for a day, bring it back to you. So I just started doing that over the summer, making some money.
Yeah.
Again, unskilled, didn't start anywhere. So I go into Jim's shop for the first time right after he opens, and there's 2 F-40s, not one.
Oh, wow.
2 in the woods in Pennsylvania. As a kid who grew up watching Michael Schumacher win year after year, like, this doesn't make sense to me. Like, how is this even possible?
Yeah.
So I'm like, hey, Jim, do you need me to detail your cars? Like, just kind of jokingly, like, I touch the F-40. And he's like, yeah, do you want to come in tomorrow and detail the F-40? It's dirty right now. And I'm like,
just like that.
You're serious right now? And he's like, yeah, come in. Like, let's do it. So the next day I was detailing an F-40, which, jump into the deep end with touching cars that are, I went from detailing.
I would be terrified.
Oh, that's exactly what I was. I was mortified. Like, well, this doesn't make any sense to me. Anyways, Jim had a lot of faith in me. He'd known me for my entire childhood, so he knew who I was. And that
he knew you were responsible.
Good. I'm not going to put a big gouge in the F-40. Like,
he knew you respected cars.
Yeah. I think technically he had me detail like some old Celica or something like that first. And he's like, okay, you can touch the F-40 now.
Yeah.
Like, you're not going to destroy this car. So this part isn't part of my history, but like, it's a fun story, like telling
awesome.
About this.
Yeah.
Well, there's actually 2 parts. So the first one is, so I'm quite tall. I'm 6'3". In the process of me detailing the F-40, I mean, you have to sit in it because you have to clean the interior and everything. One of the saddest moments of my life was the realization that I don't fit in an F-40.
Oh. You know, I've like, heard that. I've seen, even when you watch car review shows, like some of the people, like they don't fit, like their head, or especially with a helmet. You wouldn't fit there with a helmet, right?
You have to sort of like squat down really low, and then your legs are like spread around the steering wheel, and then because your legs are spread around the wheel, now the shifter is into your knee, and you're not comfortable on the pedals. And oh, if I ever to put a helmet on to do this, it would be even worse.
Jeez, I'm 6'1". I'd probably struggle too a little bit.
You might be okay, but the point is that if I could afford an F-40, I could afford a custom seat for an F-40. So like, I guess it's really not a problem. But
yes.
You know, the way it was built, I don't fit in the thing. So, that was like, don't meet your heroes. I mean. It was very cool to be in an F-40. Don't get me wrong. It is not the actual saddest moment of my life. I have some actual trauma, but like,
yes,
it was just this is weird.
Did you get to drive it or no?
I have moved F-40s around in parking lots,
okay.
But never, I've basically never fully even gotten off the clutch before. So no, I haven't actually had fun. I've ridden in them on track before.
That's cool enough.
Which is spectacular. Like, they are every bit as cool as the whole world thinks that they are. The sounds they make, the way they move, the power, the acceleration out of a car that is now 34 years old, same age as me, like, unbelievable that they could do that long ago. So they're still the coolest car in the world to me. And that's me having worked on them for years. Like, it is still the coolest thing.
A lot of people, that's still a poster car. I think people around our age, like, I remember one of the first model, I still collect model cars. The first model that my dad gave to me was a Ferrari F40. And I wish I still had it, because it just takes me back.
Yeah, it's a wild car. But anyways, I'm getting into the weeds on this. But the other funny F40 story for me that day that I was detailing it is that, I'm being super ginger with the car. Like, I'm afraid to touch it with a rag, because I'm like, I know this is single stage, one layer of paint, and you can see the carbon through it. Like, you have to be very careful, and the car's worth a lot of money, and like, this is my first time doing this. Like, being super careful. So it comes to the point where I have to like open the door and close the door. And if you've ever touched a door in an F40, they're carbon, so they're really, really light. There's no weight behind it. It's like a potato chip for a door.
Of course.
And the latch is, unless perfectly adjusted, they don't really catch very nicely. So there's a bit of a really throw the door closed because it won't latch correctly. So I'm here like trying to close the door, and I'm like pushing it really gentle and like pushing it a little bit heavier. Jim like looks at me and laughs and comes over, grabs the door and slams the door. And he's like, that's how you close the door. And I'm like, oh my God. Like, what's good?
Better him than
like,
you.
It's a car, dude. Like, it doesn't matter what it's worth. Like, it's just a car. And this thing is really a race car, which means you have to abuse it to do anything with it. So like, it was just like, oh my God. Like, he slammed the door and he's like, don't worry, it's fine. So yeah, anyways, that's some of my
I probably would have done the exact same thing.
Oh, I was like, again, he grabbed the door, it slammed it, and I was mortified. I'm like, what did I do? So I started detailing with Jim over summers, and then that kind of led to, okay, well, maybe we start doing oil changes and start doing, let's go to the racetrack for some of the club events. He had a number of customers that had retired Ferrari Challenge cars or even street cars that would do Ferrari Club races at Lime Rock and Watkins Glen and VIR and local racetracks. And hey, you can start checking tire pressure and taking the wheels off and start cleaning the cars. And, you know, I loved what I was doing. So just one thing led to another, and I started doing more at the same time that I was in college studying for engineering and doing Formula SAE. So like, I very rapidly over those couple of years kind of developed into like, okay, now I can really have a lot to do at the racetrack. I was set in school on working for like a big automotive company or trying to go into motorsports from a really high corporate level. And I discovered really quickly, I did an internship with General Motors that just showed me that I have no interest in actually working in a corporate situation.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. It was a cubicle farm, and you're just a number, just doing project management. And this isn't actually as cool as designing cars. I wanted it to be.
Yeah.
So that was a light bulb for me. Like, racing is a thing you should actually go and pursue. So out of college, I went back to gyms full time for a year, where I kind of led, I was technically the team manager, but at a club level. So it was just managing the schedule, making sure who was going where, what cars were doing this, kind of doing some engineering on the cars, just kind of overseeing some things. Again, at a club level, so nothing crazy, but
yeah,
I still really enjoyed it, and I was still close to home, saving some money. I got an opportunity through gym to then go engineer on a proper Ferrari Challenge team. So at the time was the 458.
Yes.
So this is that John guy that I told you that I met at Watkins Glen when I was 10 years old or whatever. I then went to work. Yeah, as a kind of, he mentored me for a number of years. So then I worked Ferrari Challenge for an entire season. That next year then led to doing Ferrari Challenge and Lamborghini Super Trofeo. So I've never touched a Lamborghini before. So I'm like, oh, I'm a Ferrari aficionado. I don't touch Lamborghinis.
Yeah.
And I had this stupid arrogance that I look back and I'm like, you're just an idiot. Why? They're all race cars.
Exactly.
So Lamborghini Super Trofeo. And then that led to working on Ligier LMP3 cars again, as an engineering kind of junior engineer. And then the next year, a GT3 program was added. We ran a Lamborghini at Daytona and Sebring that year, and then the program kind of fell apart. And then the following year, we did it with a Mercedes across all four of the endurance races in IMSA. There was a period of time where I technically left working at gyms, and I worked at the Ferrari Philadelphia dealership as an opportunity to change some things up.
Yeah.
But I ended up going back to gyms because I realized that dealer life wasn't fun either. But this is even before I really get digging into the engineering side of things. So when I was at what I would call pro motorsports level, I know people are going to say that Ferrari challenges in pro racing and have all their comments that they say about the driving skill there, but I understand it. But it's on IMSA weekends, on pro weekends with pro
it's crew, professional motorsports. Yeah, it's a race. It's
professional
car.
Motorsports. Yeah. So I learned a lot as a data engineer was my title. So I was the overglorified computer jockey. So, you know, downloading data, analyzing, going through, making sure the cars are running correctly. Where can we find time for the drivers? Diagnosing problems, recording video, kind of just information gatherer for everyone on the team, and then working with a race engineer to help him, again, diagnose problems with the car, or what setup changes do we want to make to make the cars go faster, and how do we tell the drivers to drive differently. So it was always kind of like a key part of the brain trust of let's go faster and make the car work.
That's really interesting. That's always been a position that I've always, I mean, that position exists pretty much on every racing team out there, I would say, for the most part.
Professional
level.
Anywhere that I use the two terms for people who are racing. There's participants, people who go out and participate in races. And I'm not knocking it at all, because just the fact to get into a race is a pretty serious thing to do. But if you're just going out and having fun, that's fine. Competing, where we are putting work and money is being spent and we are trying to win and we are doing everything we take to win.
That, you got obligations.
That is a... There's commitments involved in that. So that's where Ferrari Challenge, again, was more, again, not knocking for a challenge or Super Trofeo or any of those things. So that's it's just in a different realm.
Slightly different level.
It's a different level of intensity, I guess you call it. And then the GT3 level was pretty serious. But, I mean, on the teams I've been on, we've won a championship in at least every program I've been a part of. So we won Ferrari Challenge championships multiple years. We won the World Finals at Daytona, which was really cool. So we won top class over top of the Europeans at Daytona in a Ferrari. Our driver got a trophy from Sergio Marchionne, who was the CEO of Ferrari at the time. Yes. So that was pretty cool.
That's a cool experience.
Then we won the Lamborghini Super Trofeo Pro-Am North American Championship, and then the Pro-Am World Championship in Italy, which was super cool.
That's amazing.
We won the 2017 Prototype Challenge Championship in IMSA with Kenton Cook and P1 Motorsports. That was pretty cool, being part of a pro team. And then Kenton was he's a very pro driver. Shout out to Kenton if you're watching. I think he's a silver rated driver, if I'm not mistaken. So yeah, that was a very serious program. And then in GT3, we never technically won a championship in that, but we were very competitive with it. And to even participate in GT3, especially at the IMSA level, it was pretty serious. So I was calling strategy. I built our whole timing stand. I was doing all the engineering on the car. Frankly, I was doing the work of like two or three people. I didn't know that at the time, but I would never make me do that again if I were to work on that team. It was just too much to do correctly and for too many things to go wrong. So,
right.
But that was all cool. So all this is to say that I saw so much of the performance development and was a part of all of that, being kind of the information person. I was a key part of all of that. And I saw on these IMSA weekends that are, you know, we're Friday in the Watkins Glen weekend. So today was all the practice days, all the support series are doing all the races. Starting to gear up for, okay, let's get ready for qualifying tomorrow. So like we're shaking down through things. So on a 4-day weekend, you're getting one or two practice sessions per day that are at most 45 minutes or an hour at a time. There's a lot of time left in all of those days. And I love simulators. So I'm like, why has no one brought a simulator to the racetrack and like done coaching with it? Like, why is it not a tool at the racetrack? I mean, surely people bring simulators to the racetrack all the time for marketing activations or for fun or this, that, or whatever it is. But why has no one taken a really good simulator?
At this time, was sim racing still very something that all the teams were using, even outside of the track? Like drivers had their own? That wasn't really common back then, was it?
Now we're talking 2018. It was pretty big. It's not what it is now.
No,
but it was big. I mean, iRacing was kicking butt. I mean, you have all these sim product manufacturers. Again, nothing like today, but it was pretty serious. We're not talking dinosaur technology. It wasn't where it was now. I think the difference between 2018 and now is that 2018, really the younger generation of drivers were using sims. The old guys didn't get it. I don't feel the seat of my pants I can't tell you how many times I've been told that. I don't feel it's not the same. I don't learn anything. Oh, okay. You can lose now. if that's your thinking. The thought today, and we've changed recently a number of opinions on these veteran. We work with some older drivers also. We work with Shane Lewis, who I think is actually in the building right now somewhere.
Oh, cool.
So he's done the Daytona 24, I think 11 times. He's won it once. He's been to Le Mans 4 times. He's done something like 68 24-hour races in his career. Professional race car driver his entire life. He's won Trans Am championships. His trophy case is overflowing. He was kind of, I wouldn't say against simulators. He just never had an experience that really delivered any value for him.
Right.
Before he worked with simulator companies, and there was always just like, this just doesn't do anything for me. What do I get out of this? I know this is a useful tool, but I can't make it work for me. And then he met me, and then that all changed for him. So, So again, we saw this opportunity of why don't we take a really, really good sim and build a sim lab into a trailer and then go to race weekends and then like kind of build our services into like what race teams do to be more competitive. Because any minute of additional, if you can do one extra lap in practice, that's like so much data.
Oh, for
especially
sure.
Especially when you're looking at like, you know, gentlemen drivers or guys who just need more seat time, and seat time is measured in tens of thousands of dollars an hour. We can use a simulator to kind of bite off more of that learning curve and get more competitive in a shorter window of time. So I got to work. I started looking at different simulator companies. I wanted something awesome. I could build my own sim myself, but I'm like, I don't want to go into the sim building business. I want to work with something that's really good out of the box, and then I'll put my brain on it and tune it, and we can kind of go from there. So I looked again, a lot of motion systems. I wanted something really commercial grade that was just going to be above and beyond out of the box. So I met with the guys at CXC out of LA. So they're right by SpaceX and right by the LAX airport.
Oh, cool.
I spent a couple days out there, visited with them, drove the sim, shared some ideas. Hey, I think this is going to work. So we ended up getting one of their pretty fully loaded sims back then, their Motion Pro 2. With triple 75-inch screens, 2 degrees of freedom of motion. It's actually very similar to the one that I'm sitting in now, which is just a newer version of that. And then I built it into a 45-foot gooseneck trailer, complete with a full coaching lab. Like, this is amazing. Not an entertainment rig. This is a driving rig, like, for coaching purposes. We had a full debrief station. I had all data telemetry being logged, live video, literal intercom that you could plug a radio helmet plug into. And then we worked most of the coaching work that we did then, and we still do now, was with Assetto Corsa, the original Assetto Corsa, or Assetto Corsa Vanilla, as some people call it.
Okay.
Just because it's the open source nature of it means that we can go in and build, we can bring in custom cars, custom tracks, custom patches, whatever it is you want to do with it. And then we can go and manipulate the physics models. What I say for Assetto Corsa is that, so say 99 or 98, whatever percentage of people who drive simulators don't really drive the real thing. I mean, plenty of people are now driving, but like when I'm talking about GT3 and LMP3 cars, really there's a very small fraction of people who are actually driving the real thing. Yeah. I haven't driven an LMP3 or a GT3 car. But the people I work with are the 1% who do. So like that details matter. So it's one thing for it to look right and sound right and kind of drive like a race car. That's fine. But I found that a lot of the base content in Assetto, when you're actually comparing it to the real thing, is not quite correct. Like there's a lot of stuff that there's a number of things that are objectively wrong. Like the Huracan Super Trofeo that was in Assetto Corsa's base content, I think was like, I was, after having worked with a real car for years and literally winning a championship and having the CEO of Lamborghini shake my hand, like, hey, good job. I'm like, this is so wrong. Like, so I went in and I just got to work and tore apart the whole physics model and rebuilt everything. So now, again, and then I had access to drivers who we won championships with, and I have all of the logger data from the team and all the technical manuals, and like obviously my engineering understanding of making that car go fast and knowing everything, its tendencies and how it responds to setup changes and just what it does. We changed the physics model, and now we have a physics model of a car that is now spot
that's
on.
Amazing. I think so everyone right now is thinking, I need to try Greg's version of Assetto Corsa with the Super Trofeo.
Yeah, everyone's like, Assetto Corsa, that's like $12 on Steam. How is this simulator guy using this? I'm like, you don't have what we have. So
no, I mean, I think people that are like, you know, like a lot of our mutual viewers or people listening to this you know, Assetto Corsa is like, I mean, it's just amazingly popular. Obviously, all the mods and content manager have kept it alive, and the community's kept it alive. And but yeah, I mean, this, when we first talked about this, I was just kind of blown away by, I didn't even realize a lot of that was possible in the back end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, if you really dig into it, it's, to me, it's not complicated. It's just a long series of text files that determine the physical parameters for the car. So like tire size and gear ratios and a power curve and aerodynamic things. The big hard one is, and this is the most subjective one, is tire feel. And that also very much comes into what your simulator is and how to relate that to what the real car does. A lot of the stuff is simple. Gear ratios, there's one right answer. It's a mathematical number that you just type in. And, you know, a power curve is not hard to figure out. And there's a bunch of other things that are just pretty straightforward. How the braking system works. You can just go to the manual, boom, that's, these are the numbers I need, or the anti-roll bar rates.
So is it really just the direct data to like, or you have to do some sort of conversion to kind of make it make sense in the sim?
Yeah, there's a little bit of programming. I didn't study programming. I'm not like a coding geek, but it's pretty easy to figure out once you know where the stuff is and how to open it all up. The part that got really hard was getting the feel of a car correct. Like, how does it feel when it goes into a corner? What does it do when you load up and you're fully loaded? And what happens if you add a 1 degree more wheel? What does it do?
Right.
Does it push more, or does it, do you feel the weight move around? Like all those type of things. How much can you load it in one direction and then rapidly unload it to the other direction, or just that type of stuff. Wow. That's where we had to, I had to really take time to learn all the different parameters in the tire modeling and how to change them to get what I wanted. And then maybe we need to make a change to the sim itself. That's a feel change. And that all depends on the car also. So that's the 90% of the time of getting a car feel correct is in the tire model.
That's incredible.
Which is always the point of debate. People are always talking about iRacing's new tire model.
I'm surprised Kunos hasn't called you with a job offer to come develop the next Assetto Corsa.
I would take the phone call. Well, I'm very dedicated to what I'm doing right now, but I'd be very interested in playing a part or in contributing to that discussion. It's far beyond what I do. Those guys are brilliant with what they're doing, and I am so eager to see what...
But you very much understand how a car should behave and what things should, you know, feel like.
Yeah, and it's funny because I mean, I've driven on track quite a lot. I've driven most of this past year. We've done, I think we did like 8 track days with a race prepped street car, a BMW M235i, and then I'm working on getting into a Porsche 718 GT4 Club Sport by the end of this year.
Nice.
Which I think I'm ready to go do, but you know, just gotta. I have a lot of other things going on right now.
Yeah.
But I'm working on getting into a real car, and I've gotten some other invites to go, hey, can you go co-drive with me at this race or that race? And I'm like, yes, let's do it.
Yeah. I want to go back to so what was the response when you show up with this trailer now, race weekend? What was the response? What was the feedback? Like, what was that experience like? You know, were the naysayers or that were, you know, no, sim racing doesn't work for me. Did you change some minds, I would assume?
Yeah, a lot of minds. It was the first business that I ever started, so there's a lot of naivety in how to run a business that you don't know until you do know. Without digging into a whole business podcast, it's the whole you don't know what you don't know until you find out.
Yeah,
that was a big part of it. But it was really well received by especially the younger crowd. Everyone's like, "You have a simulator in here." There's a lot of skeptical people who may have not known who I was. So who's this guy showing up with a simulator? Like, we're race car drivers. Like, what is this guy doing? What does he think he has to offer here? I usually took a conversation to like, hey, Greg has actually been here for a long time and actually knows what he's doing. So like, let's actually talk.
Yes.
So it was well received. In 2019, we did the entire IMSA calendar short of the West Coast trip. So our first ever event that I rolled into, which was for me super intimidating, was the Daytona 24 in 2019.
Oh, of course.
Which was like my first event with the new trailer, and like we're just doing this whole new thing, and here I am driving a rig onto the speedway to load into this track. Like, mind blown. That was cool for me. It was well received. I had a lot of a network already of drivers that I worked with. Hey, come check it out. Come check it out. Come tell your friends, bring people in. It took off a little slower than I wanted to, but that was more my naivety with running a business and how to market and do things. I'm just an engineer. I'm not a sales guy. So like
that's a different side. Yeah.
So we did the entire calendar in 2019 in IMSA. We met some really cool people. I had opportunities with, I spoke to actually two at the time DPI teams about doing serious programs with them to develop with them all season long. That didn't turn into anything, unfortunately, but it wouldn't have worked out anyway, because we all know what happened March of 2020. Yeah. Whole world changed. So at the time, we were planning to do the entire IMSA calendar again and the Road to Indy. We got in contact with that series and the people who organized that, who are fantastic to work with. I have nothing but nice things to say about the people, Anderson Promotions, who run the Road to Indy, or now technically USF Pro Championships. So that was a great, we were going to do both of those seasons kind of just back and forth. The schedules were just, it was just going to be 30 weekends a year. Yeah. But I was ready to do it. And then COVID happened. And then that all got kind of thrown out because the new schedules that came out months later, I just had to pick one. So we did Road to Indy for 2020 and then 21 and then part of 22. So what was nice about the Road to Indy is that it's all young drivers, and the young drivers, especially super competitive ones, the yes. young junior drivers, not beginners. These are guys who are seriously competing, and most of which that I've worked with now are in IndyCar or Indy Lights, Indy Next, right now. So that was very plug and play. Like, they get it. And it was just a matter of kind of convincing them to, I don't know, find the time of their budget or yeah. allow the team to share information with me so that we can go faster. So that, yeah, it was a super cool thing. And I'm flattered to see that there's a lot of other, we were really the first to do that. And there's a number of other companies that have started doing the same thing since.
Makes sense. Yeah.
So it was very cool to be in the paddock right next to racing teams and driving a simulator while the real thing is driving by my trailer at 75 feet away. Like, we were at St. Pete for the Grand Prix while Indy cars are out, and I'm like just doing sessions experience. With kids. It was wild.
That sure beats cool. sitting in your basement in the sim rig. A different experience.
Yeah, it was funny. The we in the beginning when I personally built out the trailer. We took an older trailer, tore out the whole back of it, and then rebuilt the whole inside. And I spent all this time thinking about noise cancellation and all this egg crate foam and what do we do to make it quiet in here? And then I realized racing is really loud when you're in the car. So like, who cares how loud it is? It should be distractingly loud. So the yeah. point where like you're driving in the sim and you hear an actual car go by outside, like right next to us. And I'm like,
I feel like
that's that would what just, that should sound like.
I feel like that would just make it more immersive, right?
It literally could not be more immersive than the real thing.
Yeah. There's and no you've, got, you've got the smells too and everything, right?
Yeah.
You know,
just it was cool. Like, we would finish up a session with a driver and they would get out of the sim and then start buckling the helmet on and then get on a golf cart and then go get in the real car 5 minutes later and then go qualify. Like, literally, people say from sim to a race car. No, I mean, like, literally out of the simulator and then go strap into the car That's and go so drive. Cool.
So that has to have been cool undoubtedly to... valuable for them, you know, that extra time, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the drivers that I've talked to, like the ability to you know, I talked to Daniel Morad in the last, mm-hmm. you know, one of the last podcasts, and it's like, he's like, I can sit in my sim and do as many laps as I want before race weekend. And I go in there much more prepped and prepared and ready than people that haven't, right?
Yeah, it's... There's a learning curve with every race weekend that you go into based on who you are and your experiences, the car yeah. and the track, and that picture is unique for you. And there's always a learning curve. It doesn't matter how many laps you've done or how many in that car or at that track. There's always a learning curve of, you know, dialing into everything for this weekend. We're on this tire now. The weather conditions are this. This is the BOP. This is my co-drivers. This is the way the car is set up. Like, everything's different every single time you go to the racetrack. So to be able to bite off as much of that ahead of time can just get you further ahead. And racing is about adapting the quickest and getting furthest up that learning curve than anyone else. So a simulator is only becoming a better and better tool to leapfrog and go further up that curve before you start. And I'm of the opinion now that if you're not driving a simulator to get ready for things, you're just doing yourself a disservice. There's people yeah. who like, there's fewer and fewer drivers now who are at a high level who are not doing it, not because they're all doing it now, but because if you're not doing, you're probably not there. So
yeah,
it's just become a part of the equation now. It's not even should we? No, it's how much are we doing it?
Yeah. It's like should be part of, it's the same as like part of the fitness program, the diet, like any athlete, right? You mm-hmm. you practice, you prepare, you work out. It's almost now a part of that regiment, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
Which is really cool. Really cool.
Yeah, and I'll be the first to tell you, as someone who has a company doing this, that simulator time does not replace real time. No. There is no replacement for the real thing. There are things that only happen in the real car. G-forces, I mean, we're in a very finely tuned, very good motion system, but I'll be the first to tell you that it's only, I don't know, 25% of the experience of driving a real car, just because you can't simulate extended sustained G-forces. It's not possible without moving 180 miles an hour and then breaking down to 60. Like, there's no engineering shortcut or magic wand you can wave to go boom 5 G's for 3 seconds. Like, it doesn't.
That's still the one thing I don't think any sim can replicate. I mean, I don't even think, like, you know, professional simulators at factories, you can really get the true G-force effect, if I'm correct, right? Like, I haven't seen anything.
I haven't driven a true, like, driver in the loop, like Multimatic or the IndyCar sims or Formula One sims. I haven't been in something that cool. Believe me, I would love to. If you were watching, I would love to come out.
Yeah. Can I come with you? Because I'd love to.
Please. Yeah, I would love to experience that. I've actually gotten compliments from a couple Indy Lights drivers that ours feels better than the IndyCar sim. And
oh, interesting.
BSing me. The number of drivers are like, I'd rather come to this than spending $10,000 a day to drive the Dallara sim. Like, can we come back here instead? I'm like, yes, let's do it. So, but there's no, to do sustained G forces like that, you need a really, really big room and a lot of power and a team of engineers and a whole lot of money. Like, it becomes cheaper to drive a real car very quickly when you're trying to simulate those forces. So, like, I know we're going to talk about it in a little bit, but the simulator, the motion that we system that we use, it's all about high frequency tactile stuff. So, like, the onsets of motion are like, oh, you can feel it rolling over a curb or a gear shift or traction loss or ABS or pavement changes or any of those things. It does really quickly, which paints a very, very vivid picture. I don't know that it's as important to simulate the sustained kind of what we call the low frequency motions, like the sustained cornering force. That it is important, and it is part of a driver's sensory input to them that feeds them information, but for tens of millions of dollars, it's not going to, like, make you a better sim driver.
Sure.
And now we're just making it more difficult, if I'm being totally honest. And that's the reason, like, I think esports sim racing teams, they're not driving motion rigs. They don't need it.
No.
It takes away, it makes the system less reliable, and they can drive the car plenty good without it. So motion systems are, in my opinion, used to make the act of driving a simulator more realistic compared to real
more
life.
Connected, maybe is that would be the way to say it, maybe too.
Definitely more immersive. And I mean, I think butt kicker is a great add-on for competitive
sim drivers.
That was
one of the coolest things that I bought. Like, I remember when I can't not use a butt kicker now. I have a butt kicker pro underneath my rig. Like, one time it wasn't working and I was trying to get, I literally went and bought another one. Because I didn't want to wait for the replacement. Because
it's crazy how, like, you take that away and you're like,
no,
something's wrong.
Yeah,
what's wrong?
It's one of the things I tell actually a lot of even new sim racers that have already sort of got a decent setup. You know, like, I think pedals are very important in sim racing. They've sort of spent some money there. They're like, oh, what should I get next? I go, you need the haptics. Definitely, it's going haptics, to. Yes. It's not a gimmick. I think it's worth it in terms of just the immersive and adding that, it's just that missing layer for me. Even before motion, like, I don't have a motion rig, but just having the Buck Kicker Pro is like up the experience quite a bit.
Yeah, we have. So this is, again, the CXC rig is technically a seat mover, which everyone will love to.
Well,
point
let's. This is a good point. Let's talk about this CXC, too. And then I want to kind of talk about where things went, you know, and we'll go into Chicane Club, but let's talk about CXC. So why the decision to go CXC, and, you know, maybe you can talk a little bit about your setup, what makes up that setup and how you put that together.
Sure. So I got connected with Chris Considine from CXC. Shout out to Chris if you're watching. I did a lot of research on pretty high level motion systems. It was justifiable for me to go with a fully turnkey, fully sorted out, robust commercial grade system. Like, we're going to put this thing through its paces, and I want it to deliver. I'm like,
yeah,
I'm
just got to travel from track to track too, right?
Yeah, I don't want something that I'm chasing a Windows driver issue because I did it myself or a connector. Like, it has to live in a trailer and go 30,000 miles a year. So, like, this thing has to be rock solid. Is it necessary to do your home sim racing on it? No. If you have the means, sure. But for most people, no. But for what we were doing, I need the real thing. So some of the things that I really liked about the CXE and still do, is that for one, it's a very, very robust commercial grade. Like this thing is a tank the way that it's built. They had, at the time, CXE had Base 51, which was a kind of one of the early sim centers where they had 10 of these lined up, and they would put people on them 8 hours a day, all week long, kids, adults, people with a little alcohol in their system. So these things were getting abused, like abused. Yeah. And I'm like, you know, if these are getting abused by people all day, every day, some race car drivers coming in at the rate that we are, these things are probably safe. So the robustness was really important to me. Like this thing has to just work. For and sure. They have a great customer support and technical support line. So that was like number one for me. This thing has to work all the time. In terms of how the sim drove, one, it has, everyone was always talking about the two big things about that make a sim feel really good. Number one is your brake pedal. Well, yes. In a real race car, we have a hydraulic system through dual master cylinders and a balance bar, and then an ABS system where it goes to your calipers, whatever that like that is. And there's the feel of the brake pedal and how a driver uses the brake pedal is ultimately the separator from the good, the great, to the Max Verstappen's. Like the how you release the brake pedal as you come into a corner is everything about what's going fast. It's a separator to me in Formula One. It's not the use of the steering wheel. It's not how you're clicking the paddles. It's not how you use the throttle. It's the brake pedal. So the brake pedal is a super critical part of driving a race car fast. So that pedal feel, again, if we're doing real driver training, the pedal feel has to be really good. What does the CXE have? A fully hydraulic pedal set. It is literally a Tilton and Wilwood pedal set.
I was going to ask you, I was going to say, was it the Tilton? I had an opportunity to try one. I think it was last year. And I was like, wow, this is different.
Yeah. I mean, and again, I think if we talk about new tech, I think there are some, for the sake of competitive esports sim racing, I don't think necessarily, in my opinion, that hydraulic is the right answer for that. But it does feel right if we're going after something that is going to be used as a driver training tool. Like the damping and the way that the pedal comes back to you, the way there's a little bit of a dead zone in the beginning. It's not ideal for sim racing, but it is what the real car is going to have. And that was what was important to me. So that pedal feel, it's fully configurable. So we can go from anything from like a car with like a brake booster, like a most street cars or a spec Miata, to like a more GT pedal, which is going to be much firmer. It doesn't have a brake booster, all the way up to something that's like a prototype or a formula car, which is a really, really stiff pedal that almost doesn't move. It's just force based. So this CXE could deliver it. The other big thing, of course, with a simulator in terms of feel is the steering. So they use their own kind of finely tuned, it's based on the Leo Bodnar direct drive system, so it can generate 40 newton meters of torque. Everyone's always talking about their newton meters.
I know.
Anything above 20 is useless. So like,
yeah,
it's not necessary. Ours can generate 40. It would break your thumbs if you let it kick you into a corner.
This has been a hot debate, especially as I've been reviewing a lot of wheelbases lately. Like I have a Semicube 2 Ultimate. I don't ever use 32 newton meters. That's for sure.
I hope not. Don't ever crash.
I'd be like, pretty jacked if I was doing that all the time.
It's a good workout if nothing else, but.
Yeah. But I mean, there's having that range though can matter, but there's other things like slew rate and torque and having that type of motor matters, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this and the Leo Bodnars, you can technically go to their website and buy one and build your own system, but they're really not built for consumer use. Like it's very sophisticated.
Yeah. I don't know anyone that owns one other than you guys, I guess.
Yeah, the only other places that they're used and why we liked it is that it's used on the IndyCar and Formula One sims because it's it's a commercial grade tool. It was never built for consumer usage. When I say powerful, I don't mean in terms of newton meters. I'm talking about in terms of adjustability and the feel, the range, the crispness and response times. It's after we did our tuning magic on it, everyone's like, this is the best steering wheel I've ever felt. Like this is what a car feels like. And we can, you know, with different profiles, we can make it go from prototype to GT car to street car very, very quickly. So the steering feel is pretty phenomenal. CXE, all of the hardware that a driver touches in a CXE rig is from a real car, which again, for the sake of sim racing, is overkill. But we're doing this for the sake of working with real drivers. So the pedal set, again, is a hydraulic Tilton pedal set, all out of a real car, like literally out of the catalog. You can go and buy this, and it's the same stuff that we had in the LMP3s.
It's wild.
Which is pretty cool. Yeah. The steering wheel is an actual MPI wheel with all of the buttons out of like a race car catalog, all the shifter switches that are out of a catalog. So when you click the pedals, it's the same feel from a real car. It's not, again, which is built super overkill for the robustness required of a race car, not required in a sim world, but it's what we have here because it's what the real drivers use. And then the seat and seatbelt, we custom ordered our current ones with Sawbelt seats. We do a lot of work with Sawbelt. They're based here in South Florida. Good friends with those guys, and a shout out to them.
Yeah, really cool seats. Really like
them. They're really good. I'm in the GT pad seat now, which is really cool because it has all these Velcroed pads that you can get in different sizes, so you can fit people of different sizes in the car with just swapping some pads out pretty quickly. And then real seat belts on seat belt tensioners. So when we hit the brakes in the sim, seat pulls forward and it pulls against the shoulder belt. So you actually get some braking feedback on your chest.
I was going to ask you if it does have the tension built into that sim. Yeah.
Passively, which to me, in my opinion, with seatbelt tensioners is the right answer. The active ones where they actually are kind of
like the tension R system, I guess, right?
Yeah. Yeah. In my opinion, just the input lag from that, it just doesn't do it correctly. Whereas this feels a lot more natural and intuitive. And is it the same as hitting the brake pedal in a real car and feeling the G-force? No, but it is a direct feedback tool on your chest for getting a sense for how hard I'm hitting the pedal. And you can kind of just, again, it's, you have to relearn a couple of things from the sim from the real world, but it's a really good feedback tool. That coupled with a hydraulic pedal, you know what you're doing on the brake pedal every time you hit it in here, as close as you can in a sim anyway. So, and then our setup we had were the triple 75-inch screens. Back then we were running 2K and I think 60 frames, which sounds archaic by today's standards, but
60 frames is tough.
Yeah, it was really big. And I know there's a lot of debate around the right answer for displays. And I know there's mathematical equations for the right answer around all that, but our stuff looked really good. People got in and, you know, it sold really well too. So that part was important for us. And then we had a 5-channel surround sound, or like I said, we could literally plug in a helmet plug so that we could plug in, a driver could come with their steel helmet, plug it right into our system. We had an intercom and then the audio was all fed.
Oh, really? So they would come with their own helmet and then you're just plugging in?
Yeah. If you had the helmet, bring it in, plug it in. And we could talk. And I think for me, again, for the sake of immersion, putting a helmet on and having the, the limited line of sight and the weight of it on your shoulders, feeling it, it very much transports you to the mindset of I'm driving a race car now. So it's, you're never driving a race car without a helmet on. Like, that never happens. So doing it in a simulator, again, if you're sim racing, it's one thing. If you're
doing home is going to try putting on a helmet now, Greg, that's what's going to happen now after this.
If you have one, I encourage you to do it. That's what it should put you in the mindset of, oh, this is, now we're really doing this. So I do it sometimes when I'm like training, really training to go do it in real life. It's pretty cool. So, and then the PC builds at the time was a 1080 Ti, which was the latest, greatest, most awesome thing around. Our new ones have 3090s. I know 4090s supersede that, but honestly, we have everything maxed out and they look fantastic. So we do have VR in here as well. We use the Valve Index, but honestly, I mean, and they're super impressive, but with our triple 77s at 120 frames, they look really good when it's set up correctly. Yeah. And it's just easy to just get in and drive for most people.
I have a VR headset, and it's like, I got it because I wanted to try it out just for my own knowledge, for understanding and reviews and things like that. But it's, just the comfort and the for me, the detail and the fidelity isn't quite there yet. Even with a 4090 card, I still can't get it to a point that is better than my displays. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really like VR stuff. I think it's really fascinating. Of course, when you put it on, you have the immersion of like, you can go and look in the passenger seat and then look out the window. And like that sensation is wild. But like the physical limitations of it, it's slow and the screen door effect. And that's come a long way. I've been kind of like waiting for the quantum leap for that. And I think I know where that's going in the next, if it's already going on, I think at a Skunk Works or military level with VR stuff. And I'm thinking it all comes down to processing power. Processing power has to catch up.
Yeah.
From what I've heard, they are integrating eye tracking into VR headsets now.
Yep.
So once you put the headset on, it's paying attention to where your eyes are focused.
Mine has eye tracking, the Varo Aero, the one.
Oh, it does.
Yeah.
Am I already behind on this stuff?
You're not. Well, it's. I think the Aero was kind of one of the first. I could be wrong. People will correct me, but it does. It does do. You put it on. And it auto adjusts to the person, right? And that makes a difference. That does make a difference.
So does that do the foveated rendering? Because that's where I was going with this.
I believe so. But
okay, because I need to see that then. Yeah. I was going to say how this next thing that I'm waiting for, but clearly it's already out and I'm not, I need to watch more of your videos clearly.
So. No, I mean, but you're right. I think there's technology still with VR that mm-hmm. we've not seen yet from a commercial standpoint. And I think that we're not quite there yet where I think it's like the end all for sim racing. Many people would disagree with me. This is like a hot debate in comments in my Facebook group is
I get it.
Like, Why would you buy triple screens when you can just buy a VR headset? And there's a lot of pros and cons. And what it comes down to is the user, right? Like, like it depends on what your goals are. For me, I just want to come down, sit in the sim rig, just go. Like the headset, it gets hot. You get sweaty. Like there's other issues with it. But
even the best ones I've ever been on, you get eye strain. I can't drive for more than half an hour with one. And I'm like, even when it's set up correctly, just for my eyes, for me, I'd rather be looking at, I can look at these screens for 12 hours a day.
Yeah.
And I do, believe me. But I think VR it's getting there and I'm really excited to see where it's going to go. I think it needs the quantum, it needs like a phase change. It has to take some big leap with technology and then it's going to just blow everything out of the water. And maybe then it will truly become the right answer. For now, I think it's personal, whatever you want, iPhone, Android, Coke, Pepsi, whatever, just whatever you like, just drive whatever works for you right now. The other thing I was going to say with sim technology that I think is really fascinating that's happened the past couple of years is that so CXC when I first drove their sim, it was miles beyond anything you can get from a consumer grade. Even there's no steering wheel that came anywhere close to it. The pedals were nowhere near it. The motion system, it was just so far and beyond anything that was ever made before. I think I don't want to say that's changed, as not to say anything negative towards CXC, what they're doing, but in the last couple of years with the shot in the arm to the industry from the pandemic, everyone going indoors, people's sales skyrocketed. I think a lot of the consumer products have come a very long way, very, very quickly.
They have.
And I don't want to say it's bridged the gap because it's not the same as CXC. The gap has just gotten smaller. And what I will say in CXC's defense for this is that I know they're working on some cool things. I don't know any of the details of it, but I know they're working on their whatever's next for them.
Okay.
I mean, any company would be.
Yeah.
So they know that the market's moved and they are trying to stay ahead of that, which I'm very excited to see what they're coming out with.
I think, in the last couple of years, more people have decided this is something they want to do, invest in, and the technology has gotten more approachable to have it in your home. And like there's so many options now. It's challenging as a sim racing reviewer. Like there's
analysis paralysis.
There's like, so many comparisons. I mean, as a consumer, it's fantastic, but it's also overwhelming in terms of making the decision in terms of what's right for you, right?
And there's a lot of right. There's what's nice about it is that the space has gotten so competitive.
Yes.
Is that there's not really a lot of wrong answers.
No. Nope.
It's just what's your budget and what matters to you, and then just do some research. Again, the problem is that there's just so many choices to go through. Like what do I want? If you're a beginner getting started, what do you want?
I
think the other thing I would say for any of your viewers, I've found that the magic in any setup that you have at any budget level, whether it's a Logitech bolted to a coffee table or in a CXC sim, anywhere in between, take the time to tune every single setting.
All right. It's good advice.
Every sim that I've ever driven that is the out of the box default settings, if you take the time to tune it and change it, and what do you like specifically? Do you want more tire feel? Do you want it heavier? Do you want it springier? I have my opinions and I've got a lot of experience with what I think is some pretty close to the right answer with that. But every wheel, of course, is different. Take the time to tune everything. Don't just take the default settings as like the be all end all. And also don't turn your steering wheels all the way up because it's going to shorten their life and that's not what a real car feels like. Every real driver that we have comes in here to drive is like, the wheel on my real car is a little bit lighter, but I like how yours feels because it gives me more resolution on what I'm doing.
But
a GT3 car, the wheel's not heavy.
You setting your newton meters at for a GT3 car right now?
We're at about like 20 newton meters. I think in reality, if we wanted to match, we'd probably be something like 17 or 18.
Okay, because that's what I've heard is 15 is like the sweet spot, maybe.
Yeah, something like that, depending on the tire and conditions and what you're doing and kind of all the other layers of tuning that you put onto something like that. 20 is starting to, we go a little bit heavier, And that's a preferential thing that we try to do to make up for the fact that we're not giving you all of the sensory feeling that you're getting in the real car. That's like if we gave you the real thing, it would feel light. If you go a little bit heavier, you have more information to work with, but it trains your arms a little bit heavier than we'd have in real life. So, and it's subjective. Every driver wants something different, and it's very easy to turn the dial up or down. So.
Yeah, no, that's really good advice. Set it up, you know, tinker with it till it feels right to you, right? It doesn't have to be exactly what it should be. Like, it's do what makes sense for you, right?
Yeah. If you're the manufacturer of a product, you're going to put the ultra safe, lovable settings on it. It's not really the right answer.
No.
We've done again, CXC builds an awesome product. We have retuned every bit of every part of the sim on here. So the steering, we've gone through and put our own magic on it. The pedals, we've redone. We turned them up quite a bit because they deliver them for, you know, people who just want to get in and drive. We're doing driver training. So like that pedal, the brake pedal needs to require 300 pounds of pedal force to get the car to stop, just because that's what the real car does. And then the motion system, we finally tuned so that it's, again, it's more high frequency and it transmits what you really want. I think a lot of the other big motion system, I won't name names, but a lot of the big motion system simulator companies out there, especially when they're at a trade show or a car show or whatever it is, that motion is turned all the way up. And that is nothing what a real car feels like.
No.
Not even close. Like, I got in once at an event, not a CXC, a different company.
Yeah.
I got in one as a avid sim racer. Like, I have a lot of hours, and I was already engineering teams, and like, I know what I'm doing. And I almost threw up in one, and I don't get motion sickness.
No, I had an experience too.
I'm like, this is wrong. Like, this is not even close, guys. And they're trying to sell and pretend that it's all real. And, oh yeah, it's a race car. And I'm like, no, this is not even close. And like, there's latency involved, and like, more is not better in sim racing. Like, everyone, oh, bigger is better. No, that doesn't really work that way.
Yeah. It's so, kind of a balance of everything, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I had a similar experience too, but you could, you know, they admitted to me like, yeah, we've got it turned up for you. Like, we know we'll turn it down for you. You obviously know what you're talking about, but you know, it's kind of, you know, a fun experience for people at the event, but it was making me a worse sim racer. And I'm not like the amazing sim racer by any means. I'll never say I am, but it was throwing me off quite a bit, right? It becomes almost a distraction when you've got it set to that point, right?
Yeah, it's
as opposed to helping you.
Yeah, and if you're just looking to have a fun kind of arcadey feel, I mean, turn it all the way up, have fun with it. Like, that's fine. Again, it's not my objective and what we're trying to do here. So like, in a lot of respect, we turn a lot of the motion down, which is like, less. No, this a lot does actually a lot more than a lot does in that backwards sense. So yeah, just my advice for anyone watching.
No, that's actually really good advice. Very good advice. I typically when I review hardware, I'll go on the default settings just to see what they wanted, like they wanted it to feel like out of the box. But I immediately, this has got to change.
Yeah.
But
just because it's the default doesn't mean it's the right answer.
Exactly. No, it's really good advice. What would you say to someone who's wanting to upgrade their hardware? Like, what would you prioritize? Would you say, like, I've often felt like pedals is kind of one of the best upgrades you can make? Because like you said, the braking is very important. Having a brake pedal that can really give you better feedback, better control, accuracy. What would you say?
Everyone's case is different, and of course depends on their budget. And,
of course, yeah.
That all goes without saying. I would say that a load cell braking pedal, which is really kind of the industry standard, it's hard not to find one that's like that right now, but like a true load cell that can take a lot of force would be really good. And something that's adjustable would also be nice to have. Mm-hmm. A direct drive wheel, I think they've come down drastically in prices over the past couple of years.
Amazing,
the offerings have come down, which is very, very cool to see. Anything that's gear or belt drive is, it's good for the budget point and being available, but you're severely limited by what it can do. A good direct drive would be really good. I think the other thing that is very easily lost in the mix is ergonomics. Like, you need to be comfortable, and what your body shape and comfortable seating position is super important, and a lot of that is a performance increasing thing, to the point where like when we look at real racing teams, we're not talking about this for the sake of comfort, but we don't want drivers to be uncomfortable or that they can't make the car do what they want it to do. Shane told me this story that a couple of years ago, I was getting Shane ready for a 12-hour race at Mugello in a Mercedes GT3 car in real life. He had spent years with the team already. He kind of came in last minute at this opportunity. I forget the details, but he was kind of just thrown into the weekend, like, hey, just go be fast. So we did all the sim prep and everything ahead of time. And something with how his seat molds for the seat in the race car, he had like this huge seat that he did not fit in. Like, it was just huge. And he was just like kind of falling around in the seat, just all over the place, and couldn't hold himself. And if you know Mugello, you know, Arrabbiata 1 and 2, it's this long, like fourth gear, like high G-force compression corner. And he was like falling out of the seat like every single time, like literally can't drive the car. And it cost him like a second and a half a lap.
Oh, because 100%.
He had to just, I'm going to fall out of the seat if I chuck it in there the way I know the car can do it.
Yeah.
So like, making the driver comfortable with getting a good seating position, make sure that your legs are in a good position for applying brake pressure, your wrists. I mean, fatigue is one thing if you're not doing it, but like, so that you can transmit, you can move your elbows around the way that you need to, you can see everything. Like, the ergonomics of getting your, all of that position, I think, is also really important.
Yeah. So important.
Yeah. I think, and again, the whole display thing, you're more of an expert on this than even I am, but performance is way more important than with screens and your graphic settings than quality is. Like, yeah, getting to over 100 frames per second should be your goal way before turning to 4K or turning on like smoke effects or like all your mirror effects or haze or any of those things. Like, that doesn't matter. Like, once you drive for 10 minutes, the picture quality doesn't matter so much, but dropping to 50 frames will matter.
Yeah.
So something that can run really high frame rates is important. And your whole PC build, that's its whole own discussion that I'm not an expert on.
It's a tough one. Yeah, we get that question a lot. What's a good sim racing PC build? And it's like, well, it depends on many factors, right? Your budget. But I think what you said is very good advice, and one that I give out too, is that, you know, focus on the performance. Like, the detail of the grass is not going to matter. If you're after, like, I like to strike a balance. I want things to look good and somewhat realistic. Some sims are better at it than others. Finding that balance of performance over detail is pretty critical, I think.
Yeah, I think you should target 90 frames per second as a reliably 90, above 100. 90.
Yeah.
90, 100. I mean, the more the better, but if you're in the 60s, 70s, you may want to invest in something, a better graphics card or processor, or whatever it is, to get you where you need to get that. No frame drops, like all that stuff where it could just be a really clean image where the image isn't your limiting factor at all. And obviously low latency would be, is really big too. Then once you kind of have like that functioning with a static rig, then you can start adding things like, I think, like a butt kicker or two.
Yeah,
and then taking the time with like the SimHub software to fine tune. I know a lot of the butt kickers originally were just basically audio drivers. Now they've been mapped where you can actually take sim telemetry out. So like traction loss or ABS or engine RPMs or speed. Take the time to tune all that, because that's all really useful information, and it can you'll very naturally start picking up feeling what the car is doing with it. So take the time with all that. That's important.
The butt kicker, I did a video kind of talking about that, and it's the same with motion, actually, I find with the butt kicker. I don't know if you agree with me, but less is more with that too, because when you have so many effects happening, when you see the settings, like, I want to feel that, but you can't feel the isolation between a lot of them. So it's like finding the key ones. I found once I had that dialed in, it was like, okay, this is good.
If you're the designer for a product like that, you're going to give it more than it would need for any different category. So like maxing things out is not where you should be. Like, balancing things correctly is really the right answer for all that stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, you can start talking the argument about different steering wheels for different types of driving and adjustability and button boxes and stream decks and all. I mean, the sky's the limit with all that stuff. But getting a good wheel, good pedals, good displays, and a computer that can drive good displays, that's the really critical stuff to focus on. And just like building a race car, if you're just getting started, start simple and then change one thing at a time.
Yes.
And you'll appreciate everything that you change, and everyone, you'll learn so much more that way. I mean, if you just want to blow a lot of money, go ahead and go do that. That's fine. may not learn as much as if just starting simple, and then slowly, one at a time, we're going to change the pedals, and then we're going to change the wheel and the wheelbase, and then we're going to add a butt kicker, and then we're going to upgrade the computer. Like, you'll learn so much more that way. People with race, people who discover driving on the track for the first time, like, oh, I just bought a Miata. I'm going to Sebring, and I want to put an LS in it and do this and this and this and this. And I'm like, stop. Put safety stuff in first. Like, make sure you have a fire extinguisher and a 6-point harness and a Hans device, and make sure the take it to a reputable shop and get the brakes checked and make sure your engine's not going to fall out, and like, just get all the safety stuff checked and go drive it with 104 horsepower or whatever it is that you have. Just go drive it, because it's going to be faster than you've ever been in your life before. And then go adding things. Once you like take some time and feel the changes. You don't need 700 horsepower to go to a racetrack. That's actually a really bad idea, unless you really know what you're doing.
So solid advice.
It's the same thing as a race car, as a simulator for me.
Very good advice. So. Now, I know we could talk hardware. We could do a whole podcast on hardware, but I want to kind of go back and talk about sort of how the sim racing trailer at the track, how did this transition now into today, the Chicane Club? Talk to me about where things are at right now and how you got there, because this is a really interesting story and something I think a lot of people will be interested about.
Yeah. So like I said, we did 3.5 racing seasons. We did all of 19, 20, 21, and then we got partially through 22, and a couple things happened in my personal life. My dad got really ill with cancer. Different story.
Yeah.
With the trailer starting to have some issues with it. At the same time, it's about 6 months prior to that, I met some really, who are my current business partners. I met them and we started brainstorming, like, what's the next thing? They really liked what I did. We did all these events with the trailer for them. That was also the realization I had was that, so we're based in West Palm Beach, Florida here. So right now I'm in Jupiter, but the trailer I kept at a Extreme Velocity Motorsports down here in Riviera Beach. I got a great connection with them. Shout out to Derek. Now I'm doing all these shout outs, but shout out to Derek. we discovered that even though I was going to all these race events and I had all these great clients and all these things, the travel just took so much time. In 2021, I had 33 days of on the road driving the trailer. That's 1 month of my life that year driving a gooseneck 45-foot trailer and a dually across the country. I like driving, but not that kind of driving. That was just a lot of work. And I always got phone calls. Hey, when are you coming back to West Palm Beach? Because I had a local business that people, I would just be parked at the EVM shop. When are you going to be back? We just want to come out and come just drive up and just show up and drive. Like, I don't have to go anywhere with the trailer. Best business we ever had was when we were parked in West Palm Beach, and it also didn't involve the fuel and expenses of traveling. So why do I keep leaving West Palm Beach? I mean, you go to the racetrack and you do all the stuff, and I built the whole business model for that, and it worked pretty well. But I met our current business partners, the Huizenga family. Yeah. We started putting our brains together. Like, what's the next thing? Let's go bigger. Like, what is the next thing? So we eventually got to the point of, let's build a pilot location for kind of the expansion of Symmetric. At the time, we were going to keep it Symmetric, but we've since rebranded into the Chicane Club. The big lesson we learned from Symmetric being this super hardcore professional driver coaching engineering tool, which I'm a geek. I'm an engineer. I loved it. It was really fun. We want to build this into a business. You know, we want to make money and we want to expand and do this whole thing. The social element is a really big part of all this. And naturally, there's a huge community of people. Everyone in racing is doing it because they love it. Yeah. And that's the thing we all have in common. So how about we bring people together to do this together? I'm not the first person to discover this. I mean, there's sim centers everywhere. Sure. But we really wanted to do this differently. And quality and the quality of the experience, and my background as a real race engineer led us to doing this. We want to do this as high of a quality experience as possible, and deliver it on kind of a platter for people to come and do in an arrive and drive format. So our current location that I'm sitting in right now is about 1400 square feet. And I'm sitting in one of our two much newer CXC Motion Pro 2 sims, very similar to the one I had on the trailer, just with an upgraded PC, new screens, and a couple of new doodads and gadgets, but fundamentally the same sim otherwise. And they're both linked now together on a local networks. So we can do, of course, iRacing, which doesn't require the local network, but we can also do linked local Assetto Corsa sessions.
Okay.
And CXC builds this really cool, they call it their synchro system, where that they're linked together and there's a broadcast view and you can race side by side. We just have two sims, but they can handle, I think, up to a dozen simulators all linked on a local network together racing.
Oh, very cool.
Just like an iRacing session, but on a local network. So yeah, zero lag with anything.
Wow.
So we built that out, and we built, just behind me, you can't see it from where the camera angle is right now, but there's a full command center over there that I kind of built. I took the inspiration from an actual timing stand on pit lane.
That's what it looks like when I watch your streams. Yeah. It's like, it's so cool. It's like you have this race team behind you. anyone that hasn't seen it, like, you'll see when you watch Greg's channel, which I reckon you do. It's very, very cool, very professional.
Yeah, I always want more screens. Like, we have four screens back there, and I'm like, no, we need more another screens. Four and another four and another four. Like, more screens. There's, I think we did the math, there's 23 screens in this building before you start counting like phones and iPads.
Oh, my goodness.
There's a lot of screens in here. So we have our command center that where we kind of run the show, we can do all the back end stuff. So when someone comes in and gets into a simulator and drives, they never touch a mouse or keyboard ever. Our mission is like, maybe if you have to log into your iRacing account and you need to type in your password, here's the keyboard, type it in and then give me the keyboard and we'll walk away.
That's so cool.
I mean, a lot of real racing programs are arrive and drive that you pay or your sponsor pays for you to show up and go driving. Well, why not do it the same way with the simulator world? And with really high level sims. So we've got, our command center, we built out a purpose built debriefing station where after a session we go over, we sit down across from the driver, we have a TV right there. We pull up all of their data with all of our track maps. And it's just like perfect for just debriefing and going through a session, analyzing everything the same way we would, on a real race weekend. So we capture everything with from the real world, we use the VBox Motorsport sim pack with their actual blue OLED lap timer. It's pretty cool because you can literally unplug it out of my sim right now and then go put it in a real car.
I've seen this. Yeah, it's really cool.
It's pretty cool. You can literally plug in a GPS antenna and then just go drive around a real track, and it does exactly the same function as in the real simulator. So, I mean, is it, again, I think for the price point, it might be overkill for your regular sim build, but we work with what we want in the real car. So, so we capture all of our video, the center screen video, and all the driver data, and then we can analyze it in VBox's circuit tools, which for those, I think you can get a version, I'm pretty sure that VBox sells a version of the software minus the lap timer on Steam for, I don't know, $100 bucks. Really? Or something.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
we'll have to put a link. I'll look into this. I'll put a link down below if
sure
they can find that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. It's what I love about VBox's stuff and why I've long been a dealer of their stuff. And before I was a dealer, every car I worked on had one of these systems in it, which is why I became a dealer, because I'm like, this makes total sense. Is that the perfect synthesis of video and data together automatically with no work involved. So in the sim, just like the camera systems that they sell for real race cars, it captures all the video and the data, and you can pull up, you pick two laps, the data will overlay and the video goes side by side and will always, all the way around the lap, position the video so that you're at the exact same time. So you immediately can see like a line difference into a corner.
Oh, wow.
So like, you don't have to like go through the data and then go open the video from the one driver and go through and scroll and find, okay, here's the corner. And then you go to the other video and then you go find the spot and you're like, okay, that's kind of the frame there. It takes 10 minutes to do that. It's instant in VBox, and you can play them side by side.
Wow.
And it's the ultimate driver coaching tool.
Oh, for sure.
And it's why we use it. And we use it in the real car. It's the same software we use in the real car. So the only difference in a real car is that you have put in a bunch of cameras, a GPS, microphone, plug it into the ECU, and then you pull all that other stuff on, and you have it. But we use it in the sim, and we use it in the real car. So that's why we do it. We also capture in, I think there's some free software packages for Assetto and iRacing. They capture MoTeC i2 data. MoTeC's awesome too, but there's just no video integration for that. And then we have our lounge, kind of a little bit that direction, which has, you know, nice setup for hanging out, watching the race. We found that it was just as important for the people not in the simulators to have a good time as the people
for
who
sure.
Are. So, and then you can't see in this frame, but there's huge glass windows behind me. So when you're outside, there's a whole line of people watching right over your shoulder as you drive, or we can draw the curtains and it'd be a totally private thing too. So
that's so cool.
So we've really built a members only club around this whole place. So you can come in as a non-member, but it really makes a lot of sense to be a member here. So we have memberships starting at just $175 a month. that gets you into a minimum of 3 events per month that are limited to members only. We just had one last night, for instance, where we were driving the Mercedes and McLaren 720 GT3s at the Circuit Gilles Villeneuve, which, F1 just raced there 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, exactly.
And we were Daphne and I, my wife, were up there for that race. So that was really cool. A very wet race, which I know it was.
Yeah, I was watching it on TV, but very interesting race.
Yeah, it was miserable getting into the track with it pouring rain, but I'm like, this is going to be such a good race.
Yeah.
Like, I was so excited. So anyways, we do a bunch of members only events where you get opportunities to drive the sims in a social environment. We take care of food and everything like that. You can, of course, as a member, then go book private sessions with us one-on-one to do hours and it's all custom fit. There's no one size fits all solution. If you're going to the racetrack for the first time and you just need, hey, what are the basics of driving and how do I get around Sebring without dying? Like, what is it?
Yeah.
Like, we can do that all the way up to, I'm racing a full series somewhere and I want, a full performance development program custom tailored to what I'm doing. And we'll do that. And we do that all the time. That's where I was up in Watkins Glen last weekend working with one of our drivers. We had done training with him for about a year. He's one of our VIP members. So he has totally unlimited access to everything that we do here on an annual basis. It costs a good bit, but it's also the least money he'll spend to go faster all year relative to the cost of running a race car. So we've been working with him for a long time, and he took 5 seconds off of his lap time from the previous year there before he started working
That's
with us.
That's huge.
And was within a second of the guys who are at the front of the field. So it's huge. Leaps and bounds faster for him. And for a small fraction of, like, you know, his tire bill at the end of the year.
Yeah,
so.
No, totally worth it. I mean, this is such a unique thing. I don't know if something like this else exists, but to be able to go to a sim racing center, have an actual race engineer with real experience train and look and analyze your data is just incredible, really.
Yeah, it's been a really fun project. And
yeah.
I love that there's other sim centers who are out there doing it in their own special ways.
Yeah,
like, that's a really good sign for the industry that it's happening. So, like, I'm not, like, upset that there's competition in the space. We all do our own things really.
You're catering to a specific clientele, but also kind of creating an environment where everyone's welcome and to come in and experience it at whatever level they are ready to experience it at. It sounds like, right? Like, hey, if you want to come, you're a pro driver, you want to come in here and shave 5 seconds off your lap time, we're here. If you want to just come figure out what it feels like to drive a race car, maybe before you go do it in real life, this is probably a great place to start, I would think. Right.
Yeah. We have one of our members came in, had never, let alone never being in a race car on a racetrack, he had never sat in a simulator before or even watched a Formula One race.
Like, oh, wow.
He was just like, I want a new hobby. This seems really cool. I want to do this.
Yeah.
So he started at square zero.
Like, yeah.
All I know how to do is drive on the real road and doesn't even know what an apex is. And we started with him and he was just in here 2 hours before we got started. He is 2 seconds off what an alien is in iRacing now in a short period of time. Like, he's really good. Like, he's come a long way. And I love seeing anyone development from any level where they are. So if you're a noob and we got you to being pretty good, that's just as much fun for me as being really great to being just one notch better than that. So I really enjoy the process of helping people go faster. Again, we've worked all the way at the really, really high level also. So we do a lot of work with Shane and all of his development, to the point where the team that Shane was driving on asked me to come call strategy with him a good bit last year too. Like,
oh,
hey,
no
can
way.
You come out to the race? Like, you've been helping Shane a lot. Like, who are you and how are you making him so fast? Can you come help us? So
yeah.
We've had Mr. Logan Sargent has been in here.
No way. Oh, cool.
Yeah, he came out. So he's South Florida based. So he came out last year. We've had Neil Verhagen, who's a factory BMW driver, in here before. Charles Espenlaub, Joe Foster, Kyle Kirkwood's been in here. Oliver Askew. I've had Colin Brown in the Symmetric trailer. He just hasn't made it out to our new location here yet. We've done a lot of work with really high level drivers. I mean, the year that we did some work with Oliver before he started his Indy Lights season and throughout that year. And then he since went on to win that championship and then go drive for Arrow McLaren and done some really cool things since. So we've anywhere from I don't even know what an Apex is to world champion, whatever it is, we've worked with them before. So, like, it's really, I love working with all of them at all the different levels. It's totally rewarding at any level for me. So
wow.
It's cool. That's cool. Yeah, we have aspirations to go pretty big with this too. So like I said, so this is our pilot location, just figuring out the details of how all of this works on the technical side, on the business side, the marketing side, just figuring out all that stuff. We launched about June of last year. So, you know, I think exactly almost within a few days, 12 months from our grand opening, we're very, very busy. Like, I'm getting very little sleep lately, unfortunately, but it's great. It's a great problem to have.
No, that's exciting. That's exciting. I mean, it's and the word travels, and it's probably just growing exponentially at this point, I would think, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We have to start saying, unfortunately, no in some situations, but that is already, we grew faster than we thought we were going to, which again, great problem to have. We're working very hard on the next location, which is going to be a new location with more space and more simulators. And that's all I can say right now.
Still in Florida?
Yeah, we'll be West Palm Beach focused. We're technically in Tequesta or Jupiter, Florida, which is 20 minutes north of West Palm, but the next location is going to be closer to central West Palm Beach. And then that's going to be kind of our flagship. Like, that's going to be the big full size. This is the Chicane Club.
Right.
And then from there, I mean, if that works, why not, you know, every metro area across the country? I mean, starting with Florida, but I think what we have is pretty special, and we've got some merit to start building into that. I mean, one step at a time, not getting ahead of ourselves, but we're excited to be taking the next step even faster than we thought we were going to.
Sounds very incredible. Exciting. Talk to me about the live stream. So recently, I guess you started, when did you start on YouTube?
We're in season 3 of 2024 of iRacing right now. We did the entire season 2. So
okay.
I think 3 months ago, and a half months ago is when we started. We wanted to reach a new audience, and it's really just me. My wife Daphne who's our marketing director. She's been helping me in the marketing side. We've got Garrett Heisinger, who's been working with me in here as a simulation operator, and then some back-end business support from Heisinger family in Southwake. It's just us. Like, we're very resource limited right now. So we're like, how do we put stuff on YouTube, and how do we start reaching a new audience with very limited time and resources? So we're like, sim racing, we should go live streaming.
For
like,
sure. I mean, it makes so much sense.
Yeah. It's like plug and play, and I've never been, all the racing teams I've ever been on, I've been the engineer. I'm not the driver. So now it's like, Greg, you're the driver now.
Yeah,
like,
you're the star. You're the star of the show.
It took a while for me to like, okay, I guess I'm going to do this.
It's really cool. It's a really, like, if you're anyone who enjoys watching live sim racing streaming, like, this is high quality, really cool, really unique. He's got, you know, there's another camera with his crew sort of behind him with all the screens. Like, it's really unique. It's really cool. And you know, Greg's giving insight as he's driving and talking about things. And yeah, I highly recommend, go check it out. Go subscribe. You have to check it out. It's really cool.
Yeah. Hey, thank you for the plug. But yeah, it's been a very fun project. And again, coming from the real racing side of things, and we have this really cool venue to do it with that is quite unlike a lot of the live streamers who are out there in the sim racing world. We wanted to share that with everyone, even if you're in the other side of the planet and you're never going to come to our location here. Like, we just want to share that this is a very special thing with everyone around. And the way that I think when you look at live streaming and sim racing, which we are just getting started with, and we've made streaming mistakes and whatnot, it's there's a lot to learn just becoming the live streaming entity, and YouTube and Twitch and Streamlabs.
It takes a lot of courage to do anything live, especially live YouTube. Like, it's honestly something I've obviously considered, but my bandwidth right now between reviewing hardware and working a normal day job, it would be a lot. And there's obviously some fear doing it. And, you know, so kudos to you, because it does take a lot of courage to jump in and do that and work through all the technical things. And, you know, for sure.
Yeah. We had some technical glitches. We had audio issues and some desyncing. And then the other night, if you're watching, go back or watch our video from Portimao. I screwed up. I forgot to put us into the race lobby before the race. Oops. And I missed the race. Like, duh, hello. So I ended up like going to just do it a Nürburgring thing. And I drove the Lotus 98 or whatever it was just to fill the time. And I'm like, you forgot to put us in the race lobby, Greg. Like,
oh, we've all done things like that. Like me going into a race and loading my qualifying setup and having no fuel by the second lap. That's fun.
I've almost done that a couple times.
That's a race ruiner.
Yeah. It's fun to do it live because it's very authentic because there's no doctoring or re-editing things afterwards. So that's what's really fun. Yeah. And the way that, again, I come from the real racing side of things. More recently, we've had Angelo Zara from Anze Suspension, who is one of the premier race car shock builders in the country. He's located just 10 minutes from us. We were there today briefly. He's an ex-race engineer also. So we got in touch with each other. We're like, we need to do stuff together. So he's now, Anze Suspension is now one of our partners.
Cool.
And he comes in and he race engineers for me for all of our streams. And again, we take this like, we try to treat this like real racing, which is overkill for what we're doing.
No, but it's so, what we know. It's so great.
We treat it seriously. Like, I know these aliens are out there just driving and not thinking and drinking Red Bull and goofing off and having their goofy Twitch streams. Like, we're treating this super seriously, and it's just the only way that I know how to do it.
No, and it's
and cool. I'm a humble 2200 I rating. Like, I'm not an alien.
Yeah.
Like, and I don't know that I ever will be, but I've been in the top split a bunch and I've had my butt handed to me most of the time when I'm there, but like, I'm still within a second of the fast guys. So,
I love how you guys approach it. I think that's so cool. And I think a lot of people would find that interesting. And it comes across as so genuine because, you know, you guys are just like, let's just do like the best stream and go into the most detail we can and really, really just nail it. Right. So yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, take the lessons from real racing and bring it into the sim world, and then take the sim lessons and bring them back to the real world. So that's what's so fun about this, is the synergy from sim and real life is so strong and only getting better. The circles are overlapping to the point where they're almost eclipsing each other.
I know, it's amazing.
So close now.
I mean, look, it's brought us together in a conversation.
Yeah.
You know, where we probably would have never met or connected and through this, right? And this sort of mesh between hobbyist sim racers, people that are just passionate, with people that have motorsports experience, can share in conversations and have common experiences and stuff, right? And that's, I think it's just incredible. And I think it's going to continue to grow. And that
if it's this good now, where's it going to be in 5 years or 10 years or 20 years? Like, the rate that... With tech, obviously, the rate of development is like anything from last year is stone age. So where is it going to be in 5 years or 10 years? Like, what are the quantum leaps that are going to happen in the sim world? I think that, like I said, I think the VR thing is really coming a long way. And I think the motion systems, again, there's still an upper limit on what you can do without physically moving at the speeds the race cars move at.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be some really cool developments that are going to come out in the next couple of years that are going to blow our minds that I can't fathom right now.
Oh, well, for sure.
So it's cool.
Well,
but
I mean,
I have a question for you that I've wanted to ask this whole time. So have you ever been in a real car on a racetrack in the driver's seat?
I've actually never been on a racetrack in a passenger seat, let alone a driver's seat.
What if I were to help change that for you?
That would be
both pretty... the passenger seat and driver's seat thing.
That would be pretty incredible. That would be pretty incredible.
Okay. Well, I think we may have a way of making that happen if you can get down here to Florida at some point.
So I'm on my way.
Okay.
That
we have some
be
cool
really
things that we're working towards doing some, again, so we're, as the Chicane Club, we're of course focused on sim racing, but as we grow, we're going to start doing some more stuff in the real racetracks in real life. We're working on putting a track day together at Sebring that I would love to get you down for, and
that
you know,
would be fantastic.
In the driver's seat, we can do some sim training here, get you all prepped for.
I was about to ask you, Greg, I just want to come down to the Chicane Club and try your sim, because I feel like it's going to be like nothing I've ever experienced before. So
if you can get here, you're
I think
you're
we need to here. Come down. I need to come down, do some training in the sim with you on Sebring. Mm-hmm. And then maybe you can, then you take me to the track. I think,
done.
I Let's think, so if you're listening, guys, I think, you know, Greg mentioned this to me, but I kind of thought he was joking, but now he said it on the podcast, so he can't go back on it now.
It's official.
Because I can hold him to it, and I'll have you guys bug him in the comments. So I think, you know, the next phase of Greg and I's adventure here, and I think this will not be the last time we talk for sure. So, you know, we're thinking we'll go down and I'm going to document my experience trying the Chicane Club. Trying his sims and then hopefully doing some laps around the track and not ending up the other way around.
Yeah. Well, having done it multiple times where like it's been a time a period of time since I've been in a car on a racetrack, you always end up like, all right, so you're at the racetrack and you get in the car and you put your helmet on. You're like, do I know what I'm doing? Like, yeah. All right, so we're probably going to go do Sebring. I'm sure you have. How many laps have you done at Sebring on iRacing?
Quite a few.
Yeah. So like, you know Sebring pretty well. There are some differences that I'll point out to you that like that is not like that in real life. So don't do that. But you start questioning yourself, like, do I really know what I'm doing? Am I going to like crash in the first corner? Because this is intense. What I will say is that you go out and you leave pit lane, and that all of that goes away, and you're like, nope, this is what we're doing. I know how to do this.
You just kind of commit almost.
You commit.
Have you seen? You know, people who haven't been on the track. You've got them in a sim, and then you take them to the track. Like, can you transition from sim racing to the track? Really?
Yeah,
does it
for
help?
Sure.
It definitely helps for sure.
Oh, totally. Compared to not having anything at all.
Zero. Yeah. Having zero.
Sim racing is way more useful of a development tool, or like just an understanding what motorsports or driving on a track at speed is compared to like driving on the roads in traffic. Like that is a totally different part of your brain. It should be a different part of your brain navigating traffic and low speeds. The way you use your pedals is different. Like, all right, so you're braking up to a stop sign for 40 miles an hour, no traffic around. You're just slowing down. The way you use the brake pedal, you slowly ease it on and you get to a nice comfortable point and then you release so that the car just nicely comes to a stop. How do you use a brake pedal on a race car or in the sim?
Boom.
Yeah. And then this nice release that comes off. The opposite of what you do.
I know.
So everything you've been taught to do on public roads, throw it all away. Like it, and the speed that things are happening is also like throw that out the window.
It's so funny because when I have friends come over and try the sim rig, it's such a weird experience for them, right? Who have not tried a sim rig, and it's that braking. It's that exactly. They just can't get it right off the bat.
Yeah. The other big thing, especially when you get into usually, I would hope that your first track day when we put it together is going to be in a very fast street, like a prepped street car. But if you got into a race car, like a properly built race car, there's no brake booster. And that part usually is like, well, what does that mean? Well, when you go hit the brakes, your foot is doing all of the work of stopping the car. So now instead of pushing the pedal with, I don't know, 25 pounds of force, just kind of lightly resting your foot on it.
Yeah.
Now you need to leg press the brake pedal like as hard as you possibly can, and that part is usually like people come into the sim and they're like, oh, is this how hard you have to hit the pedal to stop? And I'm like, it's 80% of what it is. We actually have it turned down a little bit, but you need to hit the pedal hard and fast. I mean, not instantly, you want to load the tire progressively, but you want your peak pressure almost immediately and then a nice release off as you turn into the corner,
right?
And nothing on the road would ever prepare you for that unless you're doing brake stands on highways, which I don't recommend. So sim racing, there's a natural transition. And usually when you go out, the other thing that usually takes over in real life is the whole adrenaline thing of like,
yes,
we're moving and you feel everything now. And like, this is all real and this isn't a simulation anymore. You start engaging your fight or flight response, which you don't usually, hopefully you're not engaging when you're driving in a simulation.
There's
no fear of anything actually happening, but the fear of crashing and hurting yourself and wrecking a car and spending money and all of those things and hurting someone else, that usually is a big limiting factor that you realize is that's a very real thing in real life, that there's
no
way
to kind of fear than just ruining some guy's night in iRacing by, you know, putting him into the corner.
Yeah, like the joke I always make is, all right, we're doing a sim session, we're gonna go drive Sebring in real life, we're gonna go race in real life. The beauty of a simulator, of course, is that we can go and plow through a corner and crash into the wall at 180 miles an hour and like reset and just start over again. But what does that teach us? Very little.
Yes.
And when it comes to real racing, because in sim racing, you can go past the limit. Like, so you want to, driving in a race car is about getting as close to the limit and being there all the time. And that's the fastest way around a racetrack. In a simulator, we can exceed that limit with no problems and just reset and start over. It'll ruin your race for the evening, but you exceed the limit, you're going to crash or drop a wheel or contact a guy or whatever it is, but no one's getting hurt. Mm-hmm. Well, in real life, the option of passing the limit is usually a really bad day. Like, we destroy the car and maybe hurt ourselves and someone else, not to mention the financial implications with all that. So when we're training people to drive in real life, like when you crash, I need you to know why did that happen?
Yes.
Like, we need to talk about why that happened. The joke I always make is that every time you go, I tell people, and I don't actually do this, but I need you to feel the pain of going off. So every time you put four wheels off of the racetrack, your build's $500. We're going to put it to a charity. But every time you do that, it's $500. So that's going to add up really fast. And that's still cheaper than crashing in real life. And if you hit a wall, there's going to be electroshock in the bottom of the seat that I didn't tell you about until actually you hit the wall. Like, there needs to be a fear response.
Do you actually have that in the seat?
No, like this is a joke that I use just to like demonstrate the point of like,
they probably don't question it.
Like the beauty of a sim is that you can reset, but if you're doing that all the time to find the limit, you're not learning anything. So yeah, like it needs to be, how do we approach without overcoming that? So, but I'm just so excited by where simulation stuff is going again with the tech and the communities that are around it. And of course, you know, Drive to Survive and Formula One has gotten so popular here in North America that there's this huge focus on sports car racing and just open wheel racing and stuff that doesn't just go in ovals or in straight lines that I think is really taking off. Like IMSA is getting better viewership than NASCAR is, which who thought the day that
would really
come? Yeah, it's blown away. Like I think the Indy, there's some sports car race I saw recently that had like crazy numbers that exceeded like IndyCar or Formula One from a couple of years or NASCAR from a couple of years ago. And I'm like, IMSA is really taking off. Like, I'm so happy to see that. IndyCar and Formula One, like sports car, just road course racing in general was kind of this, oh, the Europeans do it and it's on at 3 o'clock in the morning and there's nothing really to see. But like people know who Max Verstappen is and know what
it's different.
Kind of can recognize a GTP car or whatever it is now. So I'm just so excited by that.
It's very cool.
It's more mainstream now. So,
well, Greg, you're a pioneer in what you're doing and it's so cool. And, you know, I've just thanks so much for taking the time to do this. It was absolute pleasure. And I'm sure everyone is going to enjoy this conversation as much as I did. And you guys are going to see us again. Next time you see me and Greg, I'm going to be in Florida at the Chicane Club.
Hopefully you're in this seat right here.
I'm going to be in Greg's seat. I'm taking Greg's seat right there.
Yeah, let's do it. I'm looking forward to that. We still got to figure out details on our end about coordinating the event and getting it all put together, but you're in. I'm counting you in that whole project.
Yeah. And everyone's going to come along with me for the journey. So looking forward to that. So before we sign off, Greg, where can everyone find you? What's the best way to engage with you? Social media, at Chicane Club on YouTube. For one.
Yeah, at the Chicane Club on YouTube. Yeah. We're just getting started. We just got a humble 200 subscribers right
now.
Go
make that 400, guys. Go make that 400 subscribers.
Please,
come on.
Please do. We do live streams on YouTube every Wednesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern time. We usually take the 13th week off on iRacing.
Right.
That's at the Chicane Club on YouTube. On Instagram, we're at thechicane.club. We've got a good following over there that we're, of course, trying to grow also. We have a small Facebook page and whatnot right now. But and then our website is www.thechicane.club. Perfect. So those are the best things, and I'm sure we'll put them in the description
for your video. I'll have all the links, guys, in the description for you. So make sure you check them out and give Greg a watch and go watch his live stream and say Mike from Sim Racing Den sent you in the comments so he knows where you came from.
Well, please do. That would be awesome. That goes a long way for us. But yeah, like I said, we're doing one stream a week right now. I'm going to start doing a couple spin-off ones where I just do some shorter races, shorter form stuff. And we're working on some produced content that's going to go on there. So we're trying to add more and more, but you know, it's a lot of time and resources to do it, but we're building our YouTube right now. And we're working on getting onto Twitch. I'm having some problems with getting that integrated right now, but we'll be on Twitch soon also.
Very cool.
So, but thank you. I want to say thank you to you, Michael, for
thank you. My pleasure.
For even responding to my email that I sent you back a little while ago and then for having me on. But
no, I think I'm so glad I did. Yeah, it's been a pleasure meeting you and looking forward to what's next. So very cool.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. Let's go drive Sebring.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks everyone for listening or watching. If you have any questions or comments for Greg or me, and you're watching this on YouTube, drop a comment down below. If Greg has some time, I'll ask him to take a look and respond directly to anything about sim racing, the Chicane Club, or real life motorsports. If you're new to the podcast or channel, consider subscribing on YouTube or your preferred podcast platform. If you have any feedback or suggestions for me or ideas for future guests, let me know in the comments or reach out on social media. Until next time, stay safe and enjoy your racing.